Keith, just have fun.
Oh, it will be. Thank you.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and unfortunately, Dr. Melody Fox is not with us today. But each week, I will continue to bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Now, having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, think about it for a minute. And think of the last truly important conversation you tried to have. Okay, everybody got it? How did that turn out for you? Did you argue? Were there voices raised? Did it go nowhere or worse? Or, I mean, did it end up in the same place that it always ends up? If it did, how would you like to see that change? How would you like both you and your spouse, teen, or child to be heard, understood, valued, and rightly responded to? Now, today we're going to learn from a relationship and communication expert how to easily engage in meaningful talk. And to help us get there is Keith Dorsch. Keith is the creator of the Communication Cure, an internet-based tool that easily builds relationships through meaningful talk. Keith is quick to point out that he is, first and foremost, a husband of 17 years and a very proud father of six children with the ages of 5 to 16. That's quite a spread. Now, professionally, Keith has guided over 350 couples through week-long relationship-building intensives and has spent 10,000 hours helping families and individuals heal from life's pains and grow to reach their full potential in life. Now, Keith's successful approach and tools for resolving communication problems has earned the praise of doctors, teachers, army chaplains, and therapists all around the continent. So, Keith, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much, Alan. It's great to be here with you, and thank you to all your listeners for tuning in and listening on this important topic of communication today.
Well, it really is, and I'm so glad to have you on. One of the areas that we work in a lot is working with at-risk youth, and in doing so, we're communicating with the parents and getting a lot of information, and we're usually doing that over the phone, and then we're going and we're communicating with the teens. And in literally every situation, once we sit down and we're talking with these teens, the first thing that comes out is, my parents don't understand me, my parents don't listen to me, or something along the lines that just points out that at some level they're not communicating, and that some of the acting out or some of the issues that they're going through are tied directly to this lack of communication. So again, for that reason, I know that we have a lot of people that work in the field as far as educational consultants and therapists and stuff, as well as many parents that are trying to improve their own communication skills, not only with their spouse, but with their children. So again, thank you for being here. Now, I want to ask, let's just start, kind of break it down. What got you interested in this? How did your interest in helping others in this type of really meaningful talk develop?
Well, you can definitely, there were some things in childhood that contributed to my interest. As a child and a teen, I would say I avoided relationships with close family members, but I wasn't aware of it at the time that that's what I was doing by shutting them out. And then I had a couple of good friends growing up in the teen years that were incredible, and we never fought, we never had conflict, and so I thought things were going along quite well for me until I got married, and I married a fiery Italian girl. And yeah. And I went for a job interview, and she had a special needs brother, and she needed to hire someone to work with him. And I applied, and I went to the interview with her, and I left that interview and called my friend and said, I've met the girl I'm going to marry. And she thought nothing along those lines whatsoever. And eventually, as I spent time working with her brother and being around her, I noticed that she had some problems in her life. She had an eating disorder that had started at the age of 5, and so at this point had been going on for 18 years. And I took her to a doctor to get help for that, and he gave her 6 months to live. Said, you're going to have massive organ malfunction. She was way below in her weight, a very sick, depressed, suicidal girl. And I fell in love with her. So people marry equal. And although my problems weren't as visible and obvious as hers, I had this complete inability to relate to her and communicate if anything, if there was any conflict. As long as things were fine, I was good. But as soon as there was conflict, I would shut down. And so while we were dating and engaged, she let me help her and speak into her life in those areas of suicide and depression and eating and all that. But once we got married, things turned, and I felt a lot of rejection and a lot of attack coming at me, and she would take off and just say, I'm leaving, and I would not go after her. I had nothing to say that I could communicate to her to bring the situation down to a calmer place, and I would just go in the bedroom, pull the covers over my head, and fall asleep. That's at 10 o'clock in the morning, because I was so stressed. It wasn't a physical tiredness. It was an emotional stress on me that I didn't know how to relate and connect with my wife in a way to help her at times like that. So 10 weeks after we were married, she was in a psychiatric hospital for 4 months. And while she was in that hospital, the psychiatrist diagnosed her PTSD, permanently disabled, not able to function in life, given a 1 in 500 chance of overcoming the eating disorder, and told she damaged her body so bad she'd never be able to have children. And now we have 6. The oldest is a boy, and then I got 5 beautiful daughters after that. So for this, you know, I that story of my own life gives me hope for everybody, because now, you know, we love each other, we value each other, we invest in our relationship, open up our checkbook before our kids were old enough, and you'd see that we were paying babysitters once or twice a week to go on dates. We just love being together and investing each other. But the communication was not always there, and now it is. So I've practiced what I teach in my own life, and I've been teaching it to others probably for 10 years now, and seeing great results. So the hope I have for people is what I've seen happen in my own life and marriage.
Now, you mentioned, and as I said in the introduction, that you have 6 children. How have the children influenced you and furthered your understanding of communication?
Well, they're an influence to me every time I look at them, because they are the next generation. And I like working preventatively with people and preventing them hitting problems down the road when they're teens and when they get into marriage and relationships. So I view every conversation with them as an investment and an example to them of this is what real communication looks like, sounds like, and feels like. And hopefully, you know, with 5 daughters, I'm going to get these guys knocking at the door, and some of them are probably going to try to charm them and appeal to them that way. And hopefully they'll say, you know what, the way you're talking to me, it just doesn't match the way my dad talked to me. That's not healthy. And so I'm motivated by that. In talking with my children and spending time with them.
Well, now you, and again, your oldest, I believe, is 16 years old. So are you telling us that, and my guess is you must have started very, very young to get them to trust this level of communication, because there's a lot of people out there that would say, you know, at 16 years old, a giant needle came out from, you know, sometime within the last year or so, a giant needle comes out of the sky and sucks out half our brain as parents, because all of a sudden we're not very smart anymore, which means we're probably not giving that good of advice. So tell us how you've structured this in such a way that even as they become teenagers, that they still trust the information that you've given them as to how to communicate at a better level.
Yeah, I remember we came to the U.S. from Canada. We lived in Toronto. I remember when my son was 18 months old going on bagel breakfast dates with him. And he loves Thomas the Tank Engine, and mm-hmm. Toronto has a great subway system. And so we would take the subway and go to a bagel place and have a breakfast date together. I could have gone somewhere closer. It would have been quicker, save time, save expense. But making that connection with what he was interested in and making it a time of connecting with Dad, I saw as so important back then. So dating my children, dating them and connecting. You know, when I talk about meaningful communication, it really, the foundation behind that is connection. And uh-huh. It's very difficult when a parent may realize their teen is struggling and maybe rebelling and acting out in different ways, and they try and establish a connection, then it's very difficult. There is a way, there's a process, I think, that parents can follow to rebuild that relationship and establish it, but it's much easier when you start young. And, you know, my five-year-old daughter, when we've gone on a few dates and had a car that needed some shocks on it, so it was a real bumpy car, and we just drove not far from our house for some ice cream, but the car was hitting every bump and bouncing up and down, and she always calls it our bumpy date. Can we go on another bumpy date? I remember that. And so it really does leave an impression on them, spending that time building that relationship. And you'll know when you lose it with your child, that connection. You know, because you've had an intimacy and a heart connection, you'll feel when there's a separation there. And hopefully you'll be able to approach your child and say, hey, what's going on? I just sense that things are different.
Well, And first of all, that's beautiful, and I agree completely, starting from a very young age. But now if we're to talk to, say, a lot of the parents out there to where, you know, their child has become a teenager and they just, whatever it is that you try to set up, they just, you know, being with their friends is more important, you know, and they start most sentences with, you don't understand. Mm-hmm. What are some suggestions that they can do to try to, I'll use the term rebuild, but to maybe revive that relationship so that they really do feel like, you know, no matter what, they can trust what it is that you're saying.
Start with humility. Acknowledge that the relationship doesn't exist at the level that teen needs. Not so much at the level that the parent wants to have it, but that the teen is not getting their needs met in that relationship, and apologize for it. Give some time to examine yourself and say, have I let my job, my friends, my hobbies, other stresses in life distract me and take me away from giving you what you need? And be specific, I would say, and start and acknowledge those to your child. And that might be it. You might just have that conversation. Just say, hey, you know what? I realize I haven't put into you the way I need to, and I'd like to start doing that again. And then stop there. And maybe don't bring anything up for a couple of days after. Your teen or your child has to do something with that statement. And it can have an effect on their heart, that their heart opens to it, because they know deep down inside it's what they've always needed. When people and teenagers finally get what they've needed their whole life, they can often kick back in anger. Because something inside them says, I've needed this from you my whole life. I've needed you to understand exactly that my whole life, but you never have. And they get angry because there's been a loss there in time. Let them process through that, and don't take an angry response as, oh, my child's never going to open up. You know, I did that wrong. I always tell people, anticipate some frustration on their part, but let them sit with it. And then maybe a couple days later, the other day I mentioned and apologize that I hadn't spent time with you, and I'd like to do something with you in the future. If we were to do something, you know, if we just had half an hour together, what would it be? What could we do? And do whatever they say, as long as it's not breaking the law. And, and get involved there. Let go of your picture and your expectations of how it's going to look like. I worked a lot with married couples. And when a husband says, I just don't know what to do with my wife, I'll just turn to the wife and say, tell him what he needs to do. And she'll tell him, and she's bang on. And, and it'll work the same way with a parent and a teen. The parent asks, after setting it up the way I suggested, that teen will give input and suggestions that are valuable and will actually help the relationship. So start with the humility and give it time. Don't come in and apologize and say, I recognize I've done all this, and now, hey, let's go and do this tonight. Your child, you need a little bit of respect there and give them their space and appreciate the process of it. So that's a starting point.
Yeah, I like that. And what I hear you saying is that you go in and plant the seed and then just continue to nurture it. It may not take growth immediately, but just continue to nurture it so that they know that you know, you're still there, you're still offering, you're still making yourself available to do those things that maybe they might be more interested in.
Exactly. And that's challenging for a parent, because if they find out something about their child that they're not pleased with, they're involved in some behavior or some drug or some activity, all the reaction kicks in and they just want to jump in and fix it real quick. And tell yourself you're not going to die waiting a couple days to get back in touch with your child and just, like you said, plant those seeds.
Now, I had noticed, I went on your website and I noticed that that you talk a little bit about how the brain functions. And by the way, while I'm mentioning the website, it is www.thecommunicationcure.com. And they actually have something on there that you can click on. It says if you want help, if you, you know, want something right away, go ahead and click on it, and you can you can fill something out and I would assume have somebody get back with you, which I think is very nice. I'm glad that you have that. But what I keyed in on was, you talk a little bit about the brain, and so tell us a little bit, I mean, what does the brain require to function optimally in relationships, and what role does meaningful communication play in this?
Well, I'll answer that, and let me just step backwards and say, one of my daughters in the past had struggled with seizures, and they would come on around sleep. So either she'd be waking up or she'd be falling asleep, and she'd fall into these seizures, and they would last really long. The longest was an hour and three quarters in length before they could stop it. But there's always some symptoms before they would come upon her, and one was that she would have sore eyes, she would be hungry, and the fact that they were happening around sleep, and those are all functions of the brainstem. And we went to a lot of different doctors and hospitals and tried to find, you know, the root cause of all of this. And finally, we talked with someone, a functional neurologist in town, and they said, well, all those symptoms are functions of the brainstem. And they said, if she has a weak brainstem, you won't be able to raise her eyebrows, because your brainstem is what raises your eyebrows. Now, nobody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
We do now. And so we asked her, raise your eyebrows, and all she could do was open her mouth really wide and tilt her head back, but there was no movement in her eyebrows. And the doctor said, well, what she needs is she needs stimulation in her brainstem to activate it. You know, the brain only responds when it has input. So he said the nerve going to the brainstem is on the left side of her face. So he took a Kleenex very lightly, three times, stroked her left cheek. And that sent the stimulation through the nerve to the brainstem and said, raise your eyebrows. And she raised them. We were amazed at something so simple. I call it the $85 an hour Kleenex, because it enabled her to raise her eyebrows. And he said, now do that twice a day, and that will be strengthening her brainstem. And so we did it. And eventually she developed wrinkles in her forehead, because the strength of the brainstem was so strong it could create that. So then I started talking to these guys about relationships and doing some studying on that. And I learned about something, I call it the presidential center of the brain. It really controls everything in your brain. And I thought, well, if my daughter's brainstem can be weak and made strong, what about those parts necessary to run relationship? What if they're weak? How can a person strengthen those? What can we do biologically for that? And I found this place in the brain. It's called the right orbital prefrontal cortex. And it is the commander-in-chief of your brain. And therefore, it controls everything in your body, whether it's your immune system, your reactions, your emotions, the ability to delay gratification, the ability to pursue what you desire, the ability to reach your goals, your memory, all of those things. And I thought, what if a person had weakness in that area? How could you strengthen it? And I found that three things strengthen that part of your brain. One is loving touch. Another one is soothing music. And the third one is experiences of joy. Now, joy is different than happiness. You could have your kitchen remodeled. That would produce happiness. You could find out you're getting a large tax refund this year. That'll produce happiness. But it's joy that is relational, and that's coming into the presence of someone who's glad to be with you. And that message comes out their eyes at a very fast rate, in 1/6 of a second. You know if that person is glad to be with you or not. And when you have those encounters, that strengthens that part of the brain. And the reason you want that part of the brain strong is because if it's offline, if you're in stress, if you're with someone who's indifferent towards you or angry at you or afraid of you, you're going to sense that, and that part goes offline. And the next area that will in your brain that will drive you is the area that manages fear, anger, food, and sex. And those things will be running your life. And those are all good things. You need all those. Fear is good. It says there's something I've got to do here or my life's in danger. But what you don't want to do is fear people. Anger is good. It tells you something's wrong in a situation. It tells you, hey, I'm being abused here. This isn't right. But you don't want to use those to solve the problem. That destroys relationships. So meaningful communication engages you at a brain level in a way that incorporates closeness and loving touch, music, and your core emotion towards that person being able to be communicated out your eyes that you are glad to be with them. And a lot of people don't have that message in life, but there are people they are glad to be with them. And so in life, when you're stressed, the amount of stress you're experiencing is greater than the amount of joyful experiences you've had with people. Then you go offline and you stop being who you want to be. And you do things that are self-destructive, that aren't taking care of yourself, they're relationship avoidance, and it's just not good. It's a terrible pattern and path for people to go down.
Well, and I really like the fact of where you're going with this in regards to the brain, and I'm also envisioning now people driving down the street trying to raise their eyebrows to see how strong their brain stem is.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you got it.
But I would say we're going to take a break. But again, we are talking about the communication cure. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we will be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We are talking with Keith Dorsch. He is the creator of The Communication Cure. And Keith, as I look, we have a caller online that is calling to talk a little bit about this subject. Caller.
Hello, Alan, Logan Clark.
Logan, hey, buddy, how you doing?
Okay, how about you, man?
I'm doing great.
This is really weird. I've been listening to your radio show, but I'm not hearing you now on the show. I'm hearing your ad.
Oh, you're still hearing the ad?
Yeah. Now you're coming back.
Okay. That's probably
There's a delay. There's a long delay.
There's a 7-second delay. So I guess you got to bring down your radio. I guess, you know what, I was probably supposed to say that was to bring down your radio. Because I forgot about the 7-second delay as well. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway. So, I didn't know you were going to be talking about the brain, my favorite.
Okay. So you've got a question for our caller, for Keith?
Yes. I was raised in Southeast Asia from about 19 to 29, and I learned they have a thing in Southeast Asia called the 10-minute drawing, and it teaches you, they start this with kids, they teach them how to exercise, just like a muscle, exercise the brain. And what they do is the 10-minute drawing is they send their students out with a chair, no pen, no pencil, nothing, no paper, and they study a landscape. They just look at it for about a week. They literally go out every single day and they study it, and then they go back to the class and they get a drawing board and they have 10 minutes to draw what they've been looking at for a week. And what that does is it forces the creative side of the brain, the right-hand side of the brain, to work just like exercising a muscle, because you have to recall the analytic, you have to pull from the analytical side and the creative side. And we use it in investigation. Have you run into this before with the left and the right-hand side of the brain as far as being able to exercise it?
I have not come across it in the way that you're saying. I've seen scientific studies out there where they will scan scan a monkey's brain while it's licking an ice cream cone, and then they will scan the monkey's brain while it's watching a human licking the ice cream cone. And the monkey's brain is exactly the same as if it was licking the cone, but it's not. And there's one part of the brain that actually just pulls the trigger on it and actually causes you to act. But it's like golfers watching videos and football players watching videos of the perfect play and the perfect form.
Right.
And it is burning it in their brain so that when they do have a chance to act, they act in the right way. And so in relationships and communication, you want to be talking with teenagers about how are you going to handle that situation. You know, give me a word picture of what you're going to do. And by doing that, I believe, like you're saying, you're strengthening that part of the brain for down the road when they enter that situation. They're more likely to do what they've thought about previously.
Yeah, we use it in investigations. We have, you know how you drive home from work, you know, and you get home and you get there and you don't even remember driving there? Everybody has that happen.
Yep.
You get there through osmosis. I mean, your brain just gets you there. And because you're thinking like crazy, you're thinking of a whole bunch of things, the day in the office, what you're going to do tomorrow and everything. Well, what we do in investigations is we'll have a pool table, and we do briefings around a pool table, and it has nothing to do with the game we're playing. All we're trying to do is occupy the left-hand side of the brain, the analytical side, something that you can do like driving home, putting balls into a hole or a dartboard. It's real simple to do, but it locks up the analytical part of your brain, which frees the right-hand side of your brain, the creative side. And while we're playing pool, we can literally creatively think of how to solve a case.
So Keith, how does that tie in now with utilizing the one side of our brain so that we don't get sucked into that emotionally negative part of the of our brain, you know, to where, you know, we're in a conversation and it's starting to go bad. What can we do? Is that the type of thing we can do that Logan's mentioning, where we're going to use occupy that other side of our brain so that we stay in a more, I guess, logical state of mind rather than letting the emotion take over?
You can do that, and that's why you want to have conversations with your children and your teenagers and even your spouse before the situation arises. Because if you talk about it, engage with them in a connected way, knowing that they're going to hit these situations down the road, or you're going to hit a time where there's going to be a disagreement, then you can remind them and say, remember that conversation we had about this very topic of curfew? Let's go back and look at how we were talking about it then. The other thing you can do is when emotions start to get raised is give a person a choice. I've implemented this a lot in counseling. The ability to choose is at the front part of the brain. That's where you want to be. The back of your brain is more where fear resides. And as people become fearful in a situation, in a conversation, they can get angry, all that stuff. You want to move them to the front. So I just give them a choice. I say, would you like to take a break now? Would you like a tea or a coffee? Can I get you something? forcing them to come to that front where they have to make a choice. And you can do that with teenagers, too. Would you like to pick up this conversation in 5 minutes? Would you like to move to a different place and have this conversation? Can I get you something? All those, giving them the opportunity to choose, will pull them out of the strong emotional state that they're in and heading towards.
Oh, and that makes good sense, because they're not feeling it's being forced upon them. You know, at that point, they are given a choice. They can step out of this thing that's starting to become stressful. And I think then, I mean, as a parent, as long as we acknowledge the fact that we still have to resolve it at some point, it just doesn't have to be right now. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Give them that time. Hey, we will resolve this. When's a better time for you in the next, you know, 12 to 24 hours even?
Well, Logan, I'm sorry. And Logan, thanks for calling. Do you have any other questions?
No, that's great. I love listening to it. It's dynamite.
All right. I appreciate the call. Take care.
Thanks, Logan. You take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Now, Keith, I mean, okay, how are our abilities to communicate in a meaningful way, how are they affected by, you know, feelings such as empathy or sympathy or compassion? I mean, do you have something that demonstrates the relationship between these feelings?
Yeah, this is – I love telling this, speaking on this. You know, I said before, your core emotion comes out your eyes in a sixth of a second. That's faster than a person can think. So when you come in the presence of someone, that person immediately senses what your attitude and an emotional posture is towards them. Because of something called mirror neurons in the front of their brain, these neurons actually reflect what they see coming out your eyes. So if you're a parent and you're frustrated with your child because their room's a mess, or you find their homework left at home that they didn't take, and you approach them and they see that anger in you, their brain, those mirror neurons, pick up a fraction of that anger, and right there, and then their brain makes a decision, can I engage this person? Or do I need to avoid this person? And that is empathy. And I know there's books and articles out there that say you can improve your empathy skills. Not really. I would challenge that and say empathy is something that happens faster than you can think. Now, sympathy and understanding a situation is what happens next. So if you're not afraid of that person, if you can continue the conversation and not be too overwhelmed by their emotional state, then you can move to sympathy and understand what's going on, and then very quickly move to compassion. I talk about my best day in grade 9, and my best day in grade 9 happened when I was 40. I wasn't a struggling student still in grade 9, but I went back to a local high school and talked in a grade 9 health class, and I was demonstrating the power of meaningful communication in the class, and I took two grade 9 boys, picture this, two grade 9 boys, put them in chairs facing each other going knee to knee, and the rest of the class formed a circle around them with their desks and chairs, and they watched. And what I did is I gave one of the teenage boys, the one on the left, I gave him the questions to ask the teen on the right. And I would say it out loud, and that teen would repeat it, and then the other teen would answer. And it sounds like that would be very unnatural and stuff, but it wasn't. And we started asking some questions, and we found out that this teen was a military family and had moved around a lot, and that he tended not to make friends. So I had the first teenager ask him, how do you feel walking the halls of the high school every day, not having many friends? And the teenage boy opened up and he said, I feel very alone. And then I had the teen ask him, how do you deal with the pain of feeling alone? And the guy just right out said, I go home and cut myself every night.
Oh.
And then he started freaking out, going, oh, my goodness, I can't believe I said that. Can't believe I shared that front of class. Oh, no, what an idiot. And I just said to the class, if you have more respect for him right now than you did previously, because he's been open and honest with you, stand up. And the whole class stood up and started clapping for this guy, conveying understanding to him. We continued the conversation, found out some other areas where the guy was struggling and there was pain. And then at the end, I said to the class again, if you want to help him, would you be willing to take a piece of his pain and carry it for him so he doesn't have to? Just trying to visually demonstrate that they want to carry this load that he's carrying. He can leave that burden there. And again, the whole class, minus the one guy that fell asleep in the corner, but the whole class stood up and said, by clapping that we want to carry your pain. Now, that's very contrived. I led them to an exercise that connected them, empathy, gained understanding and sympathy, and then I moved them to an act of compassion where they demonstrated their concern and love for that person. What was amazing was when the class ended, and I was talking to the teacher, and the student who was in pain was standing beside me, and a student came up to him and said, this is another grade 9 boy, came to him and said, you know what, I have you in my Spanish class after health class. Can I walk with you to that class so you don't have to feel alone?
Oh, now, that's beautiful.
That is a loving response. When people are positioned and connected in a way that they can empathize and sympathize, they will, their brain will kick in and find a compassionate act that they can do to resolve that person's pain. And that, if that can happen in a grade 9 class in public, it can happen in a lot of homes and families around the country.
Well, it certainly can, and I know that in working with teenagers also, I tend to go in and I'll sit in at various programs with a particular group of at-risk youth, and a lot of these same methods, I guess, are used there. But one of the things that I can recall also is that situation of one person opens up. And in that particular situation I'm thinking of, the facilitator, after this person opened up and then felt almost like, you know, they had said too much, facilitator asked, as you did, everybody else, and there was 15 other girls in this, and asked, how many of the rest of you have felt this same way? And again, all but one raised their hand. And as you're saying, for them to now feel like they're not alone, you know, that the boy walking the halls was probably feeling like, I'm the only one feeling this. I'm the only one that's new here. I'm the only one that feels alone. And realizing that you're not, I think, has such a great therapeutic, feeling for each of them. So, I completely agree with what you're doing and applaud you for it. So now with all of this information out there, why do you think most of us out there or most people are not able to build their relationships through this type of meaningful communication?
Good question. I think first off, if we have parents who are carrying a lot of stress and a lot of unresolved wounds and hurts in their life, they can easily get triggered by the actions and the words of a child or a teen, and they kind of go offline relationally and aren't able to be there to take care of the child, but they're trying to take care of themselves and protect themselves perhaps from more hurt, from more feelings of guilt as a parent, from more feelings, protecting themselves from feeling inadequate, things like that. So there's definitely personal issues in the parents that make it difficult in connecting with teens and even their spouses. I would say that the resources out there aren't adequate for the way, you know, if you understand, like we've been talking about the brain and how people are designed, a book on improving communication isn't really going to help very much unless it's a situation where you're ignorant and confused. And you say, I just don't know what the topics are that I should talk about with my teen. Well, then a document will solve that emotion of being confused, and then an email or something online can list, here's 10 things to talk to your teen. And if you don't have any other issues, that information is enough to help you. But beyond that level of pain and hurt and upset, information doesn't help. So if confusion is the mildest form of pain, it's kind of like, hey, what time is this radio interview going to be broadcast live? All you need to do is check the email and you got it. But at the opposite end of the spectrum of pain is the feeling of alone. That's the worst pain a person can experience, that teenage boy is experiencing. And information isn't going to solve that. Even flowers won't solve it. Candy won't solve it. Even a card of apology won't solve it. The only thing that'll solve the feeling of alone is the presence of the one that loves you, that experience of someone who's there, who loves you and is glad to be with you. And there's not many resources out there that can provide that for people and help them. I have a funny story about salad. Growing up, I had a friend, and his grandmother was inviting them over for Thanksgiving, And she called the family and said, you know, looking forward to you coming over for dinner. I just want to make sure everything is right. So I want to know what's your favorite salad dressing? And I, oh, that's so kind of you for thinking of us and asking that question. As a family, we typically all like Thousand Island dressing. And so they showed up for Thanksgiving, and there it was, the Thousand Island dressing on top of the Jell-O salad. So bit of a miscue on communication there. But one day I was at a store, and I saw a resource that was a conversation starter. And there's just a series of cards, and you could pick up one card, and there's a question on it. And this particular question was, what was the favorite thing your mom put in Jell-O salad when you were a kid growing up? And that can start a conversation, but it doesn't guarantee a conversation. And it certainly doesn't guarantee that the conversation is going to flow in the direction that's actually going to be meaningful. I don't know how you can turn that topic into something meaningful. And we can deceive ourselves and think that, you know, just by asking these basic questions, we're really building relationship here. Now, I do think there is a need for those basic questions to create a bridge, but there's got to be an ability, an opportunity to go deeper with it and make it more meaningful. So the books don't create that connection between people. Website articles don't create it. Blogs don't. So you need resources that are experiential to help that. And so people aren't turning to those types of things. People have their own agendas in communication. And you might start off wanting to understand your team, but as soon as they give you an answer that you don't like or that upsets you, then, well, now I'm not going to try and understand. I'm going to change my agenda to pointing out your wrong thinking. And then they get upset at you, and then your agenda changes to, well, now I need to protect myself, and I'm going to get defensive. And the agenda can change so many times, and that happens a lot in conversations. We can fall in those patterns of that. So those are a few things that definitely prevent people from reaching that level of deep, meaningful communication.
Well, and we have a listener question that is coming over the email. Let me read you this. We've got about 7 minutes left in the show. This one reads, it says, I am a very successful 30-year-old marketing and communications professional with three teenagers. My wife laughs that even with all my experience, I am more suited to talking to Martians than our teens. I am really in need of help here and have already ordered I've already ordered a book. It says, you know, but, you know, is there really hope that my generation of parents can actually establish communications with our kids as even with a sense of humor and a Mount Everest of patience, I feel I'm losing ground?
Well, I can understand that. And in creating the communication cure, this online resource, I created a resource that I actually need myself, because as much as I've been through and as much as I can teach people, I still hit those points with my teens and my young kids where my communication falls apart. And here's where I start. I look at, do I enjoy them? Can I enjoy them? Can I communicate to them that I am glad to be in their presence? And what are those things? If I'm not, what are those things in me that are blocking that? Is there a hurt that I'm carrying? My child caused me hurt. They've caused me disappointment. They've caused me pain. And that's blocking me from really enjoying my child. And after I examine my life there, then I go and ask your child, do you feel that I enjoy being with you? Can you tell me a time when you felt loved by me? And how did that impact you, and how did that impact our relationship, and can we get back there? When I'm working with couples, I always ask in their marriage, I say, are we trying to get back to a place where we've been, or are we trying to establish a new reference point of joy and happiness and satisfaction in the relationship? And that's a good question to ask your children. Uh-huh. Have we ever reached that place where you feel loved by me and understood by me and cared for me, or is it something I have to establish? And
I was going to say that's a great conversation starter right there. Depending on which direction the answer goes, you mm-hmm. still have a lot, you know. In other words, it doesn't matter which direction it goes with that answer. There's still going to be a lot of ground that you can cover with that. So I think that's a great starter.
One more thing to that email. You know, it's always easier to communicate with people who are further removed from you relationally. So in the workforce, it's easy to talk to coworkers and clients and customers because there's less risk of pain and hurt. But as soon as we get it into the family, where there's a chance of being more hurt, our walls do go up. And that's why there can be differences in those two settings.
Yeah, and boy, you got that right. Now I've got a question, and again, I don't know that I'm going to be able to get to all the ones I'd love to ask. But one is that I think, as everybody knows, you know, the internet and social media has often been criticized for taking away from truly meaningful relationships and truly meaningful communication. What are your thoughts and comments on that?
Yeah, the internet is here to stay. Facebook will. It may not return a huge investment for the investors, but Facebook will always remain on the website. So, you know, we've become a soundbite culture. Our interactions are all in small pieces. We tweet on Twitter. We can send out a picture on Instagram and think that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and we're really communicating that when we're not. We can post and we can comment on Facebook, but we're not having the relational connection developed that we need. But we can use technology to create face-to-face communication, and that's what I did with the Communication Cure, which the site is my website that you mentioned earlier, thecommunicationcure.com, does right now have an explainer video and an opportunity for you to sign up for more information. But in about 2 weeks, it's going to go live, and it is those starter questions on steroids. It is going to provide you online on your laptop, on your iPad, and your phone, a whole library of topics for husband and wife, parent and child, parent and teen. And when you select the topic you want to talk on, it's going to provide a series of questions on that. So you actually have a complete conversation. And it brings in, there's background music, there's closeness because you have face-to-face communication, and there's an experience of joy because you actually talk about something and it ends in a good place. So you're building up that part of the brain that needs those positive experiences. And that's one way to use technology to create face-to-face communication. Talk about the things you need to be talking about to either restore a relationship, repair it, renew it, or just maintain it and strengthen it.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Now, again, yeah, I just want to mention that again. It's thecommunicationcure.com. You can go on now. You can sign up. You can, again, it's going to launch in 2 weeks. Keith, I've got so many more questions that I'd love to ask. I'd love to have you come back. So let's, you know, maybe sometime after the launch, you know, let's see if we can. I'll talk to my producer. Let's see if we can get you back on, because I think this is a great thing that you're doing, and you're keeping, you know, communication out there for everybody at a high level, and I think that's just one of the strongest things that we can do in any part of our life, be it family or business. So, thank you for that.
I would love to come back and share more on this communication and. Answer people's questions. So, yeah, let's plan for that in the future.
You got it. And again, thank you so much. And for everybody out there, thank you for listening. We appreciate it here at Answers for the Family. And be with us next week. We've got a very interesting topic. And I really want everybody to get on, because we're going to really talk about saving teens and ways in which you can help. So, again, everybody have a great week. And I hope you will be listening next week. Take care. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.